Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello again. It's another Rahul Stepper on tour. We're at the Brighton Theatre Royal, and my guest is Simon Evans. If you were looking for Christmas gifts, you could do no better than look for these Rahul Stepper Trump card game. It's a wonderful game. Look at this, with all my favourite guests, or some of them, and a playable game of Trumps. There's a Shrek in there. I'm in there. Look out for them. Go to gofasterstrike.com to buy those, plus my books. So you can get the emergency questions books there, and you can get all my DVDs and downloads. Lots and lots of fun things to get. If you would like to come and see one of these lives or buy tickets for Christmas for someone, go to richhang.com/gigs. It's the perfect Christmas gift. Everything that I'm in is the perfect Christmas gift because I am very Christmassy. I'm associated with Christmas. And also become a badger at gofasterstrike.com/badges and get loads of extras, backstage videos, ad-free audio podcasts if that's your deal. All sorts of stuff on there. All right, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahul Stepper. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Brighton Theatre Royal. You're already much better than last week's audience. Please welcome a man who is worried that he might have let down a squirrel. It's Richard Herring! Better than last week. Much drunker than last week's audience as well. It's weird. Strange thing. So welcome to Richard Herring's Lofty Singing Tenderly podcast. It's a new move, and I've got to come up with a new ideas for podcasts. There's so many of them. So what I'm going to... It's the character Lofty is going to sing... Each week's going to sing the Whispering Grass song just as tenderly as possibly, be judged by a panel of celebrities. And the twist is, it's Lofty from EastEnders. It's Lofty from EastEnders, because the other one's dead. But he's in character as Lofty, it's not the actor. And he might put on a pith helmet. It's, and like, again, that's a reference that most... I did it to you two, because I think you're the only ones who'll get what I'm talking...
I think, like, sadly, you don't even know who Lofty from EastEnders is. That's how terrible that reference is. How 20th century can you be, Richard Herring? Grow up. But I was talking. I was hanging out at Rowley's Fudge Pantry, which I was disappointed to discover actually sells fudge. And when in Brighton, that's what I say. And Rowley said he calls it Rahulastapa. And then he let me into his actual fudge pantry. It was great. So it's thanks, Rowley. Yeah, I had a weird incident with a squirrel this week. I live in the countryside now. I'm driving my daughter to school in the next village. It's a strange thing. There's a school in our village, but we didn't get in. She wasn't bright enough. It's just terrible. So we have to go to... No, there was too many kids in our school, so we have to go to the next village. And I was driving along, and as I was driving along, talking to my daughter, there was a squirrel in the road, like, going around in a hectic circle. It had clearly been hit by a car. It was in agony, right? And I was kind of caught between, A, being quite squeamish and thinking, oh, fuck, do I have to kill that? And B, thinking, if I run that squirrel over to put it out of his misery, what is my daughter going to think? I'm running over a squirrel. I remember the Tufty Club, which, again, these references are... he's meant to be good at crossing the road, but it's... And so I was dithering, because every time I'm called upon to, you know, do anything like this, I'm terrible. And even with a car, I think, well, I shouldn't swerve. Anyway, it's dangerous, but also... Just the idea of killing a living creature I was worried about. And then my daughter was in the back, and she saw it. We were talking about it, and I wondered already, as it was approaching, whether I'd hit it. I said, no, I haven't hit it. Someone else hit it. And she said, was it a baddie that did it? And I say, no, it wasn't. It probably was an accident. I don't think there's someone driving around Hertfordshire just trying to take out as many squirrels as possible and being slightly inefficient, just winging them. But it was in so much distress. And so I actually didn't run it over. I let it go. And then I felt like it wasn't even 9 o'clock and I felt I'd let a squirrel down. I thought, I'll get it on the way back. But it was 20 minutes later. It had succumbed to its injuries. And so I didn't, I just felt bad about whether it's quite a difficult choice, isn't it? Whether you murder a squirrel or let nature take its course. So I felt bad. Probably should have done something a bit more upbeat to start the podcast. What would you do? Would you run over the squirrel, Brighton? Say yes if you would.
Yes.
Monsters. It might have been survival when I'd run over it and gone, I was all right. I just hurt my foot. Sort of sound a bit like James Acaster, that squirrel, I thought. It was all right. Anyway, that's what's happened to me this week. My guest this week, he's probably best known for his portrayal of Richard in The Way It Is. Yeah? Instant recognition there from the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome Simon Evans? Richard. Yes, Richard, there he is. Hello, sir. Come in there. Sit down.
Plenty of merch.
Good there are lots of merch. You've got to have a lot. You've got to have a lot of merch, Simon. That's the rule of the game.
That's a very classy display. Yeah. Puts me in mind of Publisher's Clearance Warehouse day, things will pick up in the afternoon.
So tell us about Richard. What was, do you remember playing?
Richard. I was informed about the format of the show that you would introduce me with an obscure credit that I'd hopefully forgotten. Funnily enough, I was reading up about The Way It Is this morning, genuinely in bed, because I was trying to remember. We used to have a publicity still which had everyone had gaffer tape over their mouths to suggest they were being silenced in the same way that Tommy Robinson and the like are these days, and you can't go 3 minutes on social media without somebody appearing gaffer taped to indicate their silence. But there was one member of the team, which was Tracy Ann Oberman. I don't know if you know her. She's quite a well-known actress. She went on to be in... she was Dirty Den's girlfriend when he was resurrected from canal death to revive the nation's interest in the show. And didn't really work, but she was his girlfriend. And I don't know whether she was called Filthy Fanella or something. I don't follow the show that closely, but I don't know that everyone has to be alliterative and criminal. Yeah. But anyway, she was in it. And the three of us, the three men, because it's a 3-to-1, because that's the correct ratio for men to women in comedy, as you probably know. And as we've approximated this evening as best as we can. And
if you include last week.
And The three men, which was me, Chris Pavlo and Dave Lamb, all had gaffer tape on, and Tracy was doing her makeup. It was quite funny. She was like oblivious to the kind of serious, okay, kind of, you know, subversive nature of the show. That was the joke. I couldn't find a copy of it, and it annoyed me. But it ran for 8 series, that, and we only pulled it because it was... we made a TV episode, which is obviously everyone who works on radio, as you know, is basically just trying to get on television and is pretending in the meantime that they like the adorably sort of clubbable, rather low-pressure sort of nature of radio, yeah, and they're actually clawing their way out like a rat through a human skull, you know. But we made a TV pilot, and the controller of BBC One resigned before she could look at it, and a new one came in, and that, of course, as everyone knows, means it's death, because they just clear the desk and they don't want any leftovers from the previous administration, which is understandable. So it died, and so we all moved on. You know,
yeah.
But Dave Lamb got a job now, is mainly known as the voice of Come Dine With Me. He's the narrator of that. He's a Patcham man. Which is a province to the north of Brighton,
okay,
yes, sort of up into the Redwoods on the A27.
Yeah.
And he and his daughter Betty live up there, and his wife, whose name escapes me. And
I mean, you don't really have to put yourself in the position of naming. You could have just said his wife. I can't remember. She's called. She's going to listen.
Chris Pavlo, I think he's still with the radio theatre company, okay, and has quite a lot of buy to let in the Finsbury Park area, so he's relaxed about it.
It's good to know how the old team are doing.
You know,
I mean, that's happened
doing
to me.
Okay, basically.
It's happened to me so
but
many
Richard
times.
Richard was, he was, they, all the writers attempted vainly to take him into different and interesting sort of areas as a character.
Okay.
Ignoring my incredibly limited acting range. It was basically me. I was just doing him as me. But he was roughly based on Chris Morrison on the hour and day to day, but it was an actual topical show. That was its only twist, you know. But it was all based on that, basically. Every, okay. 95% of comedy is essentially parasitical, isn't it? If
it
not
is.
Saprophytic,
of
you know.
Stuff that I've created,
yes,
that
yeah,
is the thing.
Exactly,
that's the problem. And I get none of the money for it. I invented Alan Partridge, I don't know if you know that. So it's. Don't know if you need that. So what should we talk about? Well, let's talk about quiz shows first. I love quiz shows, and you've done quite a lot. Quite a lot of the TV quiz shows.
Do you mean panel games?
Well, no, proper.
Oh, proper quiz shows. Yeah, no, shows. You're right about that. No, I don't do panel. I'm not very good on panels, but I have done the proper quiz shows.
You've done
the
Celebrity
right.
Mastermind. You
Celebrity
won Celebrity
Mastermind. Yep.
How many points did you get out of Matter of Interest on
to win? I think it was 33, but I'm not
33.
Sure.
33. I got 34.
You got what?
34.
Was it 34?
Yeah, and I came second.
Seriously, who won then that round?
Hillary Kay.
I thought you were going to say Hitler then.
That Hitler. Came back. And his special subject was...
The more I hear about him, the less... Well, and what was his specialist
subject? His
specialist
was himself.
The Jews and what they're up to. Problematic for the question setters, that. Probably why he got some easy ones. So, what was your subject?
I did Rasputin. You did Ernest Shackleton, I believe.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So and I read three books about that.
Yeah.
I probably triangulated him. I was interested in it anyway, but it gave me a bit of a spur, and I really became quite well-informed. And I, to be honest, I could have easily answered every question from the Wikipedia page. I was so over him. I think the thing is, when you do a difficult, an academic-ish subject, they don't know where to set it. Most of people go on there, and they do question. There was Dr. Alice Roberts, paleoanthropologist of TV fame, went on very highly, you know, proper doctor, and PhD, and... Yeah, but she's entitled to use the name if she wants it, and she needs to be quite so snippy about it. But anyway, she chose the Moomins,
right?
Children's finished fairy tales, because people like to undersell their intellect. And I was like, "Fuck that! Yeah. I am bright, and I will demonstrate this." And so they didn't know where to set the questions, and so I think it was advantageous.
Did a lot. I mean, I read two very thick books on Rasputin, and I learned
the song.
Yeah, the song was they all came from the song. I learnt the names of the two police officers who had very. I don't know them now, but like I didn't speak Russian, so I had to learn everything phonetically. I learnt the name of the two police officers that arrested the killers on the day, or who were there when they came in.
They killed
him
twice.
Did not go that far.
Did they poison him and shoot him? Or
well,
something?
I wrote a play.
Oh, you've got a theory about it as well.
I don't think any of it happened.
Well,
because it's nonsense. What
right?
The actual story is like a pop boiler thriller sort of thing.
So he was building his own mythos, you think?
Well, I think Felix Yusupov, who killed Rasputin or was involved in it, I think it was a front thing, and then he made it seem more, you know, to make him more romantic and like he'd done a big bit of thing to create
was
the myth.
Was he the lover
of
the Russian queen, though? That's
no,
the
I don't think,
he was
I don't think
either,
he was.
Really?
He didn't, well, I mean, he wasn't really in Moscow either, because she's about what Boney said to Moscow
St.
chicks. He was such
right?
a lovely... Yeah, St.
Yeah,
Petersburg.
Yeah.
He did go across to Moscow. He
does
famously
not scan
danced
well,
on,
does it?
No, St. Petersburg chicks. And he wasn't that much of a lovely dear. I mean, there's I have a bit more sympathy for Rasputin than most of the historians do.
Right.
But he was still not a nice man. He would have been... I think he would have been Me Too'd in this era.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he might have been Operation U-Treat.
Would
and I think
be more like one of those... Jerry Falwell or one of those guys who try and use their religious affiliations to obscure... Yeah,
a little bit, but I think he might have been... He might have been sincere. He might have been sincere, but he certainly got corrupted. But he was stabbed in, like, 1914 or something beforehand.
Yeah.
And, like, had to run across a village holding his guts in. And so,
right.
And nearly died that time. But then he...
Yeah.
So, like, he was...
So that got the sort of you can't be stopped kind of myth going.
And then
yeah.
I think they made up the rest of it. Because it doesn't make sense, Simon, that he was shot in the head and then got up. That does not
make sense.
That,
no.
What do you think about it? And
even Russian bullets.
Yeah. Well, historians swallowed it. There's a theory that the British Secret Service killed him. And Yusupov was a friend. I don't know if this is what you came for. you get what you get. You get what you get.
I can imagine John Humphreys drumming his fingers impatiently.
But that's
you'll have an answer, though, boy. He's Welsh. Lovely rug, this, by the way. Do you bring this around with you?
No,
the rug?
This is no.
They can't see it, most of them, can they? Because they're down in the Salisbury. I've got a nice rug. I'll be honest with you. I've lived in Brighton 12 years. I did not realise that you could just hire out the Theatre Royal on a Sunday evening for your own vanity projects like this. I feel like I've been cheating myself. Brilliant.
Pack to the rafters. Just like last week. Packs of rafters. I think last week's audience went out and said, you've got to come and see this thing, and then bang, it sold out fast this week. It's been insane. Krypton Factor, you've done. I mean,
Krypton Factor was the first one. That was my break into television. That gave me the first taste of it, actually, But it also gave me my first insight into what you well know about television, which is that it's an awful lot of waiting. And normally if you do a game show or a panel game or quiz show, you know, you wait for a bit and then you're on and then you've done it. But with the Krypton Factor, they shoot like as many as four different sections over the course of a weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really kind of modular, intrusive, breaking up. And it's all done up in Granada land, central Manchester, most of it. But the assault course, you know, you are literally blindfolded and chucked in the boot of a Sierra and driven out to some waste ground because they don't want you to know where that is. You need to be disorientated and... To be honest, on the last one, Gordon Burns had developed laryngitis, so we all went up there and there was like a 6-hour wait, and then we informed he couldn't do it, and so we all went back down again and had to book out another weekend. So on the final, this is all on YouTube if you want to see it. They did, I think it was the only series where they did this. Instead of just having a series of rounds where you won points and they tallied up the points at the end, and that was the winner. The first half of each programme, you won points, and then you spent them on advantages in the super round. So you basically bought kind of... You could eliminate certain rounds. A bit like buying the Joker, basically. You could eliminate certain rounds or certain challenges, you know.
Sort of like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? They were trying to
get you on those. I think they were desperately trying to rejuvenate the format. It didn't work, and I think that was the last series. So the super round was like part physical and part kind of mental agility. So there was a sort of, you know, there was like a kind of aerial runway and then you land in a maze and fight your way out of it and everything. And one section, you had to break codes... and you work out what the code was. And it was fairly straightforward. It was like you had to hit the keyboard letter that was prior. Like you hit S if you want T to appear. Just that simple. And then these words would come up. And once you'd done that, you ran off through the lasers or whatever. And I thought I'd done all four. But one of them I'd got wrong. I'd spelt a single letter out. I headed off, not having completed that round. Climbed up Krypton Mountain and flourished my big yellow K at the top like a complete planet. And was sadly informed by Gordon Burns that I had been disqualified because I had failed to complete, you know, round three of the super, you know. And I really thought I had won at that point and I was going to be catapulted into the stratosphere, you know. And
was Gordon Burns sad or was he, like, quite smug about the fact he'd messed up? Was
I think he felt that, his system had worked. It was a kind of... There was some degree of satisfaction. But there was also a woman called... Penny something, who was the co-host of that. I don't know, anyone remember that? She's quite good looking.
I don't think this. I think you dreamt this.
Like, she looked a bit like the Icelandic woman that does the book program. What's her name? On the radio. Who's the one, very husky voice? Mariella Frostrap, yeah. She looked a bit like Mariella Frostrap. Slightly more healthy appetite than Mariella Frostrap, but... anyway, she was the one who actually informed me about it, but... Yeah, Gordon was off in the background. Another fly in the trap.
Wow.
But yeah, so that was disappointing. But that was my first taste of pitting myself, you know, against challenges on, and I liked it. I'll be honest with you.
Was that you as a celebrity, or was that you as a
no? That was me completely. I was a juggler and writer of erotic fiction.
Yeah, well, I got
that.
I saw this.
Credit. Yeah.
So, well, A, I can't imagine you as a juggler. I mean, the juggler is more surprising than the erotic fiction, I have to say.
You can do the both at once.
Did you do any erotic fiction about jugglers?
Very, very full-fitting harlequin outfit. Yeah. But,
then he grabbed her breasts, threw one up. Yeah.
Club swapping.
So were you juggling on the streets of...
I used to, I didn't juggle, I didn't get paid for my juggling skills. I made juggling balls and then taught people how to juggle and then I'd sell them, a bit like the merch after the show. Yeah, and that was the business model, really. I'd learned to do this in Australia. I travelled around Australia, sort of took a gap year, but I was in my mid-20s, so I gave up a job and had about $1,000 that I'd saved up, and I flew to Karachi to get things sort of underway. and which was not quite as much of a war zone as it has been in the interim, but it was, you know, and I left on the day that Margaret Thatcher had resigned from government, so it felt like the end of an era, a good time to go. And I basically worked my way through East Asia, India and Asia and what have you on very sort of like dollar a day kind of basis, and by the time I got to Australia I was out of cash, and somebody showed me how to make juggling balls. And basically what you do is you cut off the... about the top third of a large mineral water bottle.
Yeah.
And then you get a balloon and you stretch its neck over the neck of the water bottle. And then you get a regular measure of millet, birdseed, which you pour into the funnel. Yeah. And then you have to put your face over the water bottle like that and blow into it so that your breath goes through the grain, expands the balloon, the grain falls into the balloon, and then you stop blowing... and it forms nice little sort of, you know, like an anarchist bomb from the 1890s, you know. And then you snip the neck off and cut the neck off a couple of other balloons and fold them over the top. And then the fourth balloon, you cut some holes in a different colour, put that over the top, and you've got this lovely spot. It would go with your jumper. It's that same sort of aesthetic, you know, that kind of, you know, crazy, like a dragon's egg kind of thing. And you could make, if you got a good system going, and once you took, the only thing was you would have a permanent red mark around your face from the water bottles.
But is that why you've got the goatee now? It's just to cover up that.
Yeah. Looked like you've been rimming a pig, you know. But apart from that.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of effort for some juggling, but I mean, if you're going to get something
you could sell
useful,
the juggling balls, they would sell for about £5 a pack, and they would probably about 10 pence to make.
Right.
The balloons I buy in bulk, and the millet with a, you know, big sack. Yeah. So then I put them all in a pram and put them in the back of the van and drive it to Guildford High Street, which is a lovely picturesque high street in Surrey. I'm sure you know it, and you can see the cathedral in the distance. And loads of posh girls go into town on a Saturday, and they're always going to a party that evening. Hey, we'll get some of those for Demels. It'll be hilarious. And so you give them a little lesson, and they buy some juggling balls. And I'd sell about £200 a day, which was fine. That's on virtually no costs, you know. And that was my living essentially. And then I wrote porn during the week.
And what was that? Was that for magazines?
That was genuine. Reader's letters for... there was one called Parade, which It was direct, specifically aimed at Squaddies Parade.
Right.
And it had a lot of Union Jacks. It was a bit like an early form of Brexit propaganda, essentially. Yeah. But, and so, yeah, and there were one or two others. There was Razzle, not to be confused with... it was Rustler, not to be confused with... Everyone thinks it was... because Razzle was... had a cult following for some reason, didn't it, Razzle? But I don't know why. But, yeah, Rustler was a rip-off of Hustler, which was the big American one, you know.
Fiesta? That was the first porn mag we got hold of.
I don't think I did that one, no. I did...
It was just all cars in there. It was rubbish. Yeah. Right?
What was funny was there were Fiesta and Escort. Do you remember that? It did.
Wasn't that weird? What a weird time it was.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be... we've gone very 20th century in this podcast already, but you wouldn't be able to imagine a period where you would... The only time you could see a bare lady was finding under a bush in Shipham Woods.
Oh,
basically.
The big bag of... It was Farm Lane, brackets, unadopted, was the place where it was a little, like, it was... The backs of some posh people's houses came onto a sort of, an unmade-up road, and that was full of bushes of porn.
Yeah.
It did almost occur to you that they might be naturally occurring there.
That's why I'm going to make someone vote them. I just let it grow. But no, we had a copy of Fiesta that we just, like, you would pass it round your mates, so, like, and give them what you were doing with
but it.
But
it wasn't so much the fact that somebody had previously used it, it was the damp that had got to the pet. For years, I associated erotic arousal with that kind of musty, you know, newsprint. Yeah. Very debasing. Yeah. Took a long time in therapy to get through that. And then I, took my revenge by contributing to it in the dying days of its economic viability. But Leonard Holdsworth was the editor. He had a number of interests. I think he had some more legitimate publishing interests as well. But he was like a commissioning editor for Confessions and Letters and so on. And somehow he owned a house just off Cheyne Walk in Chelsea, a full-scale townhouse, in a very desirable neighbourhood with that. And his wife would come down with a little tray with, cakes and tea while we were discussing what the next batch of letters should be.
And so did you use your own experiences in the letters?
No.
And were you a virgin?
The first three, and then that was it, yeah. No, I was a bit too over-imaginative, really. That was the main notes I got. Get on with it, Evans, for that sake, They don't want to know all about 17th century France. The specific duties of a chevalier. We can dispense with that, But I felt you've got to build up some erotic tension. Yeah, otherwise it doesn't work,
I agree.
It doesn't work for me without
that. I don't watch porn. I think we've established that last week. I don't, there was one time that I got caught doing it. But if there's going to be a little bit of a story to get you in there.
I must admit as well, I've sometimes gone back over it, but I liked writing them from the perspective of the woman. I liked putting when I read now about these non-binary, Sam Smith, who says he's non-binary and he needs pronouns, I think we're all a bit non-binary, mate, This is not a new thing. I quite like going into the mind and imagining, and I could find that quite... Did you see that Black Mirror episode? I thought that was quite interesting, where they explored that. It was called something Vipers or something?
Yes.
Two grown men who inhabit avatars on a video game and then have sex with one another. You could do that kind of stuff with readers' letters, and it was quite... And, from my point of view, they didn't know. They were completely sold, of course. They were believing it all. But, it was quite... In a way, it was healthy, and in another way, it was probably, sublimating things that I should have been going, right, let's actually explore what it would be like to actually have sex.
Well, it would be, again, weren't the main readers of these things. I can't imagine there were many adults really reading the magazines. Maybe there were.
I don't know.
Mainly teenage boys?
I honestly don't know who the audience that you were aiming for.
The letters are the things that stay
the
with
teenage.
Me. You know, that was the thing... The pictures are all a bit scary.
I don't know. I mean, we get letters in from squatters, in particular, Parade. Right. We get them in, often in Ireland. I had about three different stories. One of them with a full-size, like A4, coloured-in illustration of him and his mate doing a house-to-house, I think it was called, just in Belfast or whatever, and a bird opens the door with a, stockings and suspenders, and it's all full-on carry-on sort of, and here we go... And then there's the sergeant comes around and he's clambering down the drainpipe. I mean, it was obvious nonsense.
Yeah.
But the fact that he'd registered that these stories were obvious nonsense and I could do one of those. And so my editor gave it to me and said, see if you can, trick this up. And that was much harder than writing an original story, making that one work.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've done this, like script editing for other people's sitcoms and stuff. I do this occasionally, much, much harder to kind of... I mean, not to say that they're rubbish, but to get into somebody else's fantasy and think, why did he find this... This is a bit sad, isn't it, really? tragedy porn, that may still be a market for that. I don't know, but...
Yeah, well, I'm very obsessed with sex robots, and I know you've talked about them on your radio show.
And at the Battle of Ideas a couple of years ago. Last year, in fact. Yeah, I was on a panel discussing that.
So, I mean, it's sort of interesting the way that technology is going to take all this stuff, isn't it? I mean, that Charlie Brooker thing is a great example of that.
I wasn't convinced about sex robots until I saw... the bloke on, not the robot, but like his genuine obvious. Did you see that on this morning?
Yeah.
That was really weird. I mean, he really is in love with that robot, isn't he?
And, well, is that weird?
it's quite weird.
Is that wrong?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting. At that precise moment where people are discussing what is gender? What is it that's specific to a male or a female sexuality? Is it... Is it just the organs that excite you, or is it the female end of the spectrum, the personality or the character or the power or whatever, these things, and then the men are just simply have visual triggers. Well, it seemed to suggest, this bloke, that some men, at least, have such basic, you know, animal triggers. They're not much better than that monkey that used to hold on to a towel while it was drinking milk. Do you remember that one, the behaviourist? Where they realised
monkeys, mate.
It was one of those early experiments where they realised that monkeys, and then presumably humans, like in Romanian orphanages and stuff, monkeys would prefer greatly prefer a milk dispenser in a cage that had a sort of furriness, like it was vaguely like a female monkey,
right?
To the extent that if they put like the furriness and the milk in the same cage, the monkey spends most of the time holding onto the furriness, just a rag, really, you know, and then occasionally will go over to the milk, but will still like hold onto the thing. That was basically that bloke on This Morning. He'd attached himself to this silicon robot, but you know, she, on TV she was queer. I mean, I think Schofield was a little bit, you know,
ready to go.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he was fired up. And I can't remember what's her name. Is it Holly Willoughby?
Is it
Willie? Honestly,
Holly Willoughby.
It is Holly Willoughby.
I think Holly Willoughby.
What about a Hollywood Willoughby? Yeah,
Holly Willoughby.
She was getting jealous. Yeah.
Wasn't the wife involved in that? Was the guy with that sex robot?
Yeah,
his wife sitting the other side, and she doesn't.
And
mind.
Then she sort of goes, "Yeah, we'll watch telly together." And then sometimes the sex robot reads the children bedtime stories. Apparently, you have to be quite careful; it's on the right setting. I would imagine. But, yeah,
so you'll all be doing it in the future. Don't you worry; you'll all be there.
It's funny because Brighton is quite traditionally, I don't know if I'm addressing an entire, how many of you are actually literally Brighton rather than sort of coming in?
Yay!
Yeah, not like an overwhelming majority maybe, but Brighton is of course traditionally and famously very progressive and liberal in its attachment or approach to sexual, marginalised sexual pursuits or whatever. But I've seen very little of this in Brighton. I see very little evidence of this. I don't know whether that's because it's for people who live in places that aren't so liberal. So maybe if you're, you know, if it's okay to just walk around in your gimp suit anyway, you know, there's you don't need that.
They're all having sex with people here in Brighton. Yeah. Yeah. Everything goes. You don't need a robot.
Way behind the cutting edge.
Yeah. But, they'll get better. The robots will get better. And then it'll reach a point, the Gemma Chan window.
Yeah.
It'll pass through that. And then you'll all be all over
The what window?
The Gemma Chan, she's in Robots. The,
is she? Okay, humans, right. Is that she like an example of the Uncanny Valley? Have you heard of the Uncanny Valley?
No.
Anyone know this?
Yes.
Yeah, see, lots of people. Yeah, some people have done the reading. The Uncanny Valley is it's the stage of authenticity or of convincing simulation where it's so nearly right but isn't quite right, that it makes you feel weird. There was a Tom Hanks film called The Polar Express, which was neither animation nor a movie. It was sort of the actors, but they'd been drawn on a bit. And it made everyone kind of go, no, that's all weird and wrong. It's like that. And that's where they're at the moment. That's where the sex robots are.
Yeah.
If they were just, you know, most people would rather fuck a fleshlight than a sort of... Yeah. You know, nearly but not quite human woman. This is something a bit too weird.
I mean,
about
it's
that.
Sort of embarrassing. I'd be embarrassed at own sort of. I joke about it, but if someone forced me to do it, it would be an embarrassing thing to have to go through with.
Yeah.
At the moment, but soon it will be awesome. That's what I'm saying. Soon it'll be amazing.
Maybe they'll be programmed with my stories. That might be.
Well, I wondered if they ever get to the position where they can do sort of virtual reality and you can go back into your life and relive situations and do them right.
Do them right, my God. Like that Richard Curtis film.
Yeah. Well, it's all like Groundhog Day, but of just shagging. I mean, it could be other stuff as well, but no one would use it for the other side. Just want to see if I can leave that job on a high note, having done all my work right. It'd be great to go back to an actual situation like when you were 21
and then you could sort of shine a specific woman's face onto the robot.
Yeah, so, it just would be essentially time-travelling in your own life through virtual reality. It'd be so real. I guess it's the holodeck and the Star Trek, isn't
it?
But just jagging. Rather than going back into the past. You with me, Brian? You're very, very repressive. This guy's double thumbs up from this guy. hoping his
the people who like this sort of stuff are all at Romish tonight. That's the
What, have you ever let down a squirrel? I let down a squirrel this week. Have you ever let down a squirrel?
What, abseiling sort of thing?
You interpret it however you like. I feel I should have killed a squirrel.
Oh, the roadkill thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, okay.
But, you
yeah.
know, it could be yeah. in another scenario where a squirrel needed your help.
Or just disappointed a squirrel generally. Yes. Well, there's the sex thing that we were just talking about. I don't want to go straight back there. If I could go back and pleasure that squirrel, knowing what I know now.
It's unlikely.
Yeah. I have killed roadkill deliberately, yeah.
Have you?
But not with a sudden swerve. The instinct is to swerve away, definitely, and then you have to reverse and do it properly.
Right.
Which is tiresome, but yeah, I think it's probably best to do that overall, yeah. I was driving through Australia once on that same gap year thing. We were in a VW van driving across the Great Western Desert.
Yeah.
And that is like a video game, and kangaroos just appear out of nowhere at night, and all you have is your own headlights. There's no street lighting at all and a very starry sky, and then suddenly, bing, 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 you know. Yeah. And one struck our van and virtually wrote it off. It was, right. And that was a huge, like, that was felt like you had slain a, you know, almost your own equal, really. I mean, he would have stood about that tall. So in order to honour him, we butchered him, and yes. And we ate him. Gradually over the next week, and I felt that was, you know, that made sense.
Where
of the,
did you keep him in the desert?
He was dangling off the back of, in his limbs were attached to various hooks, and you know, we had that. Well, it was one of those old VW campers with the rear window is on a hinge. So
didn't
you
it get
sort of,
too hot? Didn't it? Did you cure the meat or something?
Yeah, well, you give it a good, you know, and expose it to a naked flame, right. You know, to get the flies off before you started. Yeah. It wasn't that good eating either, I've got to say. I think you probably need to marinate them or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I have eaten kangaroo. I have eaten kangaroo in Australia. But
we kept his ball sack for a purse, and that actually that worked quite well. I mean, that's the thing you can buy in tourist shops.
Yeah.
I'm teaching the grandmother to suck eggs here at the moment. Got a collection of them. But, yeah, so that wasn't
an original
thing.
You were tempted to make a juggling ball out of it.
I kept his paw as a sort of, you know, like some...
Lucky thing.
Yeah, no, not like a wanky thing. Like a...
if you use a dead kangaroo, it's like another kangaroo's doing it.
Yeah. It was like a sinister sort of, you know, I wanted it on top of a cane, ideally, or something like that, you know.
God.
The kangaroo's paw. I see you are learned in the ways, etc.
Yeah,
but yeah, that's the biggest thing.
Don't like
ever
this. They don't like us talking about this.
I would happily slaughter seagulls. I know that's a divisive issue here, but my God, we had one. It laid its eggs out. So we have a little sort of the flat window on top of a sort of bay window, you know, in the floor below and outside the attic room. It was right there, you know, you could see it, and the bloke goes, you can't touch them, they're protected. Once they've had eggs, you're not allowed to touch them. The only thing you can do, he said, this is from the pest control guy, is you can drip paraffin onto the egg, and that will seal it, and the bird inside will suffocate. And that is legal in a way that just shoving it off with a broom isn't, for some reason. I do not know why. It's horrible, isn't it?
I mean,
that's
cruel.
Properly sadistic, yeah. But I could, you know, I've got a rifle, an air rifle. I could have just been 3 feet away from it and just ended the whole thing right there, but you're not allowed to because they're a protected species because they were here first. But, they are very annoying around here, although it mainly when they act in unison with a green-controlled council to maintain a healthy level of overfill from the bins. If you keep the bins under control, the gulls will follow, as a rule.
Yeah.
But, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's the main... That's the squirrel of the sea.
You're not the first comedian I've had on who's had... Rob Rouse had a sheep. I think he did a routine about it. You might have seen it.
Where he killed.
Well, he ran over and then put it in his boot thinking he could... I think it was a sheep.
Yeah, you've got to let somebody else... If you run it over, the bloke behind you can have it. Yeah, those are the rules. Yeah,
I think someone else might run over, but he put it in his boot on a hot day and then basically exploded in his car.
Oh, blimey. Because they have a lot of gastric juices, don't they? What was it? Far From the Madding Crowd in an early scene. The sheep are all swelling up like balloons and he has to go around puncturing them. Seemed to me a really surreal thing to sort of insert into a Dorset story there. But I will just mention, by the way, with the seagull thing, apparently a mate of mine who's an established maritime expert says that sailors will leave a snake
out on the deck
right,
to keep albatross and stuff away from the boat because they just don't like it, so they won't settle. And a rubber snake can be quite effective, but I didn't have one, so I did put out a dinosaur on the ledge the following spring, and it did work. So obviously something in their genetic memory. They might have just thought, well, the dinosaurs got here first, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, totally fair.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
So I'll ask you the emergency question that I've been asking everyone recently, which is, and you may have an answer to this. I think you're
an adopting a Jacob Rees-Mogg body language for the moment.
If you're allowed to take one item from a museum or art gallery and keep it as your own anywhere in the world, any art gallery, any museum, any artifact, any painting, you're allowed one thing and it's yours. What thing would you take from the world's treasures?
My favourite painting at the moment is one I encountered randomly and unexpectedly at the Prado in Madrid recently. Okay. We went there because my wife is a big fan of Velázquez and had just read a book about a Velázquez painting that went missing for maybe a couple of hundred years and then was rediscovered, and she thought this book was amazing, and so we had to go and see the painting. And tucked away, just unexpectedly, there was a painting called Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God, of a lamb being sort of tied up and ready for slaughter, that had been on the front cover of a CD I have of Bach's Matthew Passion.
Okay.
And I love the CD cover, but I'd never known where the painting was or anything, and then there it was, and it was absolutely breathtaking. It's not very big, it's about that big, and it's sort of bathed in a golden light, and it's a really beautiful painting. So I might have that.
Okay.
Or I might have the mermaid from the Booth Museum on Dyke Road, which is a very impressive fake artifact from the South Indies seas, I believe.
Cool,
Have you been to the Booth Museum?
I have not. No, I haven't been to that.
You've
one.
Been to the Booth Museum?
Yeah, of course.
That's an important local.
Yeah.
There are some. It's a great. It was established by a Victorian eccentric, and he has some really excellent tableau set up there. There's one of a seagull, I think it is, or at least some kind of large raptor plucking an eyeball out of a dead lamb, in fact. Okay. It would go quite well with my Lamb of God thing.
Lamb of God and the whole theme of this show.
Yes, exactly.
It's staying very much in cruelty to animals.
You would think nothing of running over a squirrel after a time in there. That's a good one, that. Yeah. They have a badger that was in Harry Potter as well.
Okay.
I'm not sure where.
Just running around fighting people.
Yeah.
Do you know who I am? I was in Harry Potter. Fuck you. And I'll see what other emergency questions you've got. There's plenty more to talk to you about, but we'll just have a little... what's your favourite... This is for kids, actually, but I'll ask you. What's your favourite type of dinosaur? Would you like one as a pet? What would be the potential drawbacks?
Is that a foreskin joke? Or the, Favourite dinosaur?
Favourite dinosaur. I mean, we're still in the same area.
Yeah, I mean, I keep anticipating the questions, don't I? I think the thing with dinosaurs is you wouldn't necessarily want your favourite one as a pet, because the thing that makes you them a favourite when you're young is their fearsome nature, isn't it? Which also rules them out.
I think if they were your pet, you would be able to command them as well.
Oh, okay. They show sort of loyalty to you and you alone.
You'd get them from an egg, they'd hatch, they'd think you were their mother. It'd be like a little duck, and then it was a Tyrannosaurus Rex. They'll do whatever you want. You can beat it around.
Imprinting, I think it's called, isn't it? Yeah. Yes. But we never know. Yeah. Well, I was never that fond of T-Rex. No. I always thought he looked ridiculously disproportioned. He was like a, made up by some sort of sadomasochist.
Yeah.
I don't know. I quite like the larger sort of veggie ones, really.
Yeah.
I think quite a gentle, placid, a stegosaurus possibly. I quite like the fact they have two brains. That always fascinated me. Apparently they have a tail brain.
Right.
Although that, no doubt, is one of those things that has been since disproved. All the good stuff about dinosaurs gets... No, actually, that's not true. That didn't happen. But, Stegosaurus, who apparently... This is the top dinosaur fact. Now, you might have heard this one, but it gets shared quite often on social media. The time difference between us and the T-Rex is less than the time difference between the T-Rex and the Stegosaurus.
Yeah,
did you know that one?
Yeah, I saw that the other day. I can't remember it. Yeah.
Has anyone want to whistle appreciatively at that? That's quite that is quite impressive, isn't it? In the same way that it's like longer now since the Beatles' Edwardian pastiche, Sgt. Pepper's, than it was since the Edwardian era when they recorded Sgt. Pepper's. That's quite disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
Those are weird. They're getting old, it's a terrible thing.
It's a bloody awful thing. Although at least we haven't been destroyed by an asteroid yet, I suppose. There's that, you know. I'm not a huge fan of dinosaurs anymore. I was, obviously, when I was a kid, but I think at some point, it's like a lot of things. You realise they're just thick. And I'm not that interested anymore in things that are just thick, you know.
You're living in the wrong country.
Maybe that's what started it. And get enough dinosaur in my daily diet.
Oh, my goodness. Good, let's have a look. You did a tweet the other day where you said that if you chew sugar-free gum whilst drinking coffee...
Yes, this is my great Dragon's Den idea.
It's like drinking sweet, it's like having sugar in your coffee.
Yeah, I find it much... I've never found a sweetener that I can put in coffee that doesn't ruin it, but if I'm chewing a sugar-free gum while I drink the coffee, it's delicious, and I don't
need
sugar.
Is it not a little minty?
Well, it probably is a little minty, but it probably means I like minty coffee, but... But I don't like the taste of coffee, which is a problem, obviously, in Brighton, because it is essentially, you know, we have passed the coffee event horizon many years ago. There's no non-coffee-based enterprise here now. You've either got coffee shops or you've got, like, barbers and things that will offer you a coffee as soon as you go in and you're expected to drink coffee the whole time. And I don't really like coffee, you know, so I found that to find ways. Because if you just drink it in order to consume sugar, then you start your metabolic disorders. You
don't
know.
Have to drink it, though. Don't start eating chewing gum to make coffee. Yeah, just drink tea.
I want it. I like feeling overstimulated most of the time. Yeah, I do, though. I mean, I am more of a coffee addict than anything else, really. I suppose there's other things have fallen away. I carried on smoking marijuana for about 20 years after I knew I didn't like it anymore. But I just, you know, the sort of peer pressure. But you come to Brighton and it's all about the coffee, and I like the like the feeling, don't like the taste. So
okay, well, that's fair enough.
I could try enemas, of course, but incredible. Over 100 coffee shops in Brighton and not a single one offers the coffee enema.
Right.
Despite there's quite a lot of, like, A-list role models that apparently I think all the supermodels use it and stuff, don't they? You know, have you tried one?
I have not. I've never done an enema, I don't think, of any kind.
Of any kind, no. I've only done the basic ones, you know. No, I haven't done one of any. I would only do it for that purpose. But apparently it does work. Has anyone done one? Yeah, okay.
Proud. Are you doing it now?
Is it true? Does it work? Yeah, gives you a bit of a rush, right?
Yeah, focus.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll try it. I will on your recommendation, 5 stars, I will give it a go. I drink a lot of coffee.
Yeah. Does it come straight back out again? I suppose that's the first worry, is it? How far in do you have to get the nozzle?
Let's get it about a finger's worth in.
Right.
Okay.
And then it comes out about 15 minutes later.
But under control? I mean, do you have a warning that it's coming, or do you have to wear a diaper?
It's like you have poo.
You know, you go, oh, you do it in the bath anyway, okay. Okay, so that's well,
probably... It's like you're going to do a poo, you do it in the bath. That is not like... That's like my son having a poo. That is not like... That's not how I do my poos.
God, I'd forgotten that. The poo's in the bath era. Did you use the thing that's intended for getting peas out of a saucepan? That's what we used
I did it with... The last time my son did it, my sister bought my daughter a game, which is a net... With right. some fake poos.
Oh, wow. Right,
so they play with that in the bath. Yeah. And my son did a shit in the bath, and my daughter thought it was the toy and picked up the shit.
I've kind of got to say, hand. I feel like you've invited that.
And so I then, she was freaked out by that. So then I just cleared it all out by hand.
Yeah.
Oh, and no, then a lot of it goes in the plug, and the plug had a lot of hair in it. Because we'd never, I didn't really check the bath plug. And so it was like then getting feces strewn. I liked it. I love it. I talked about this on another podcast, but that's the job I quite like, clearing out the hair trap.
Well, not when I like poo getting so much, out the but... hair trap. It's been a while since there was poo in there. But it's funny, those things are never the worst jobs, actually, are they? It's like we have a dog and people go, oh, you have to pick up its poo. And I'm like, that really isn't in the top 10 of the annoyances, of you know. I would rather, as long as it's reasonably well set, it's actually quite satisfying.
Yeah,
if you get it right, there's a sort of, you know, flourish, and then it's bagged and tied before they know what's happened. And it's a bit like an old-fashioned shopkeeper, you know, just William going for a sixpenny worth of gooseberry drops or something. Is the broken ones for free, you know.
It's very good. I guess it's not the same here in the town so much, but in my village... The Facebook page is just full of people annoyed about people doing their dog poo wrong.
Yeah, right.
Quite a lot of people, and I'm annoyed as well.
How do you do it wrong?
Well, you bag it up.
Granny
and you bag it up and then leave the bag.
Oh, somewhere. Yeah, no, that is wrong. I mean, that is just rude, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think, like, then people argue that they're going to come back and get it, but they often don't.
They don't, no.
But also, don't do it. Just fucking carry it.
It's around. Like, a mate of mine said to me, it's like James Bond and that first killing, you know, the first one's the toughest. The first one you walk away from is the toughest, and then it gets easy, and he's right. And I realised I did do it a couple of times because I didn't have bags with me, and I thought, no, this is wrong. Because it really is. It's horrible. It's really horrible, and it's disease-ridden and everything. Yeah. So I am quite particular about that now, and I am I'm pretty good on that. I have actually picked up other people's.
Have you?
If I'm out walking with the dog and I've got the bags anyway, and I see one,
I bury the, if they're buryable, because I'm in the countryside, I will with soil and stuff around.
Yeah.
It's when you see them right next to the dog poo bin, when you kind of think this. I mean, in a way, I admire the guys who let their dog shit there. Think, no, I'm not even transferring.
What they could make is they could make poo bags that had a sort of camo pattern.
Yeah.
And were biodegradable, and then you could just fling it and they would settle out, you know, you could get them some distance off the park.
Yes.
But they all seem to be sold in like vibrant colours, you know, like you might want to go clubbing with them or something. And so I don't know.
My greatest fear about having kids was the poo, that the poo would be a problem. And I'm so.
That's all fine.
So absolutely fine.
I genuinely miss changing nappies as well.
Come to
really
my house.
Good heavy nappy. Because that was the thing. My wife would change them too soon, and that would deprive me of the pleasure of changing a really heavy one. For fuck's sake, let it build a little. Yeah. Come on.
Do you think we set up a business where you allow fathers who no longer can change the nappies of their own kids to come to your house and change your kids' nappies? I mean, that's a bit dodgy, isn't it? But if you said, are you doing it because you just miss being a dad? I am.
Like changing the urine. I mean, I do the other ones, but that's not enjoyable, you know. And that was always that is terrifying, to be honest, when you have a daughter and you are wiping the anus. You know, there's that fear. Oh, it's a bit like those fish that the Japanese cut up and eat raw, but you have to get really close to the poison sac. You know what I'm saying? There's that, I'm really working around this area very carefully indeed. Didn't like that so much. But a really good, heavy... And then the really satisfying thing was you do it upstairs in her bedroom and then drop it over the stairs for whoever was downstairs to pick up. Another thunk. There was a really good thunk onto the stairs. Ah, fucking marvellous. And also, of course, using the dirty ones as, to protest against various municipal decisions and things, you know.
Yes.
So that was unexpectedly
brutal. It was good, it was nice. I think you and I probably politically come at things from a slightly different angle. For a while, you were... you were one of the only... I don't know if you are really right-wing, but as a comedian, you're more to the... to the right? The
well, I mean, I think on that, just to, you know, because it's a vaguely serious question, I think my favourite answer was probably the one that Stephen Fry gave, which is that it's just interesting to play with different ideas and not just kind of accept the orthodoxy that seems to prevail at any given moment. My politics are not by any means set in stone, and I'm always curious as to why people hold one view or another. And I can understand certain perspectives, you know, demanding, you know, certain opinions, or they would influence those opinions. But mine wouldn't necessarily. So I would always think, well, is there another alternative point of view? And I think I did have a sort of, not quite an epiphany, but a moment about 10 years ago, probably through Twitter, when I'd accepted pretty much from university era that although I was a bit more instinctively right-wing than most people in the comedy community, I accepted that probably the intellectual, the intellectual high ground in politics was occupied by the left, whereas the right were more kind of, you know, I suppose, sort of, well, that's all very well, but I want my, you know what I mean? That kind of like mindset. You think, oh, knuckle dragging, skinhead thugs on the right, and like intellect, and you have to try and create a democracy in which everyone feels that they have a share and so on, the social contract. But still, let's be honest, the intellectuals have established that the left wing is the correct point of view. But through Twitter, I discovered genuine intellectual right-wing thinkers. You know, people, not all of them like, entirely engaged with modern thought. Some, like Chesterton, for instance, who I've read quite a lot of now, who establishes perfectly coherent and, I think, legitimate ways of looking at society and understanding it in ways that the progressive left have rather left behind. So I just kind of champion those views so that they get heard. But I'm not somebody who kind of feels very strongly that they can see, oh, my God, if you would only listen to me, I can see how society would work. I can mainly see that it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, I sort of don't feel it's... I get what you're saying, and I don't think it's comedy's job necessarily to come up with answers, and it's comedy's job to point out what's stupid about everything.
Yeah,
I think it does become slightly problematic. To be honest, most comedians aren't very political at all, and so there's plenty of actual...
And they don't think it through very much. Yeah. But it gets to the point where on Radio 4 panel games, like the News Quiz, for instance, you just get four comedians all spinning the wheel in the same direction because it's much easier to get laughs that way. If there's a certain momentum, the flywheel is turning.
Yeah.
If you try and turn it back the other way and go, you know, then you essentially you're jamming a spanner into the works. It's much easier to just keep spinning it. But, you know, a lot of people said Mock the Week, for instance, in, you know, which is not, again, terribly political, but to the extent that it does have targets, you know, in the build-up to the Brexit referendum, I don't think you heard a single person speak on behalf of what turned out to be half the country. And I think that that disconnect that can occur there is quite dangerous, potentially. I think people want to see the BBC capable of offering them a balanced news and current affairs service, of course, but they also expect to see a certain amount of balance in light entertainment as well, to the extent, you know, even if 70% of it is, like, non-political at all, if the 30% of it that is political is just basically saying every Brexit voter is either a closet racist or doesn't even bother to stay in the closet, then, and it turns out 50% of the country feel that way, then actually there's a sort of... That is a sort of failure of the network and of the job of comedy to some extent. You know, people should feel that their views are represented. They're paying their license fee. You know.
Yeah, I agree, but I think also
not that I'm making my views up, but I just feel, well, you know, there are other points of view here.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that whole thing of having to ascribe to one viewpoint and then you've got to go for everything.
Yeah.
Is kind of crazy.
No, not but, you, know, you so, personally.
So, no. But it happens on both sides. So, like, and especially with Twitter, everything gets polarized now. And you know, I asked a question on Twitter last night that I thought was quite reasonable, and I'd be getting shit all day.
Which one was it?
I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to. But it was, it was about one of those controversial subjects. But I don't think it was that controversial a question. Yeah. And then the people extrapolate from that question to, you know, then they're within two tweets they're talking about something completely different.
There are
you
one
also
or two subjects on Twitter that I don't even remotely discuss.
No, well, I wish
anymore.
I had.
You know, it probably was one of those, and we probably know which one it is. But, you know, one or two comedians have been drawn in and will probably never, you know, extricate themselves.
Yeah.
But you should be able
to discuss stuff and you should be able to say stuff you don't think.
The thing that I found, I talked about this, there was another podcast, which I hope you won't mind me mentioning, a guy called Stu Goldsmith does. The Comedian's Comedian, where I talked about this and how is it possible to be a right-wing comedian? And I was saying, the thing about being right-wing isn't, it's not like about marching and like kind of flushing minorities out and you know, bayoneting them in a ditch. It's about recognising that human nature is a real thing, you know, and that to some extent our experience of civilization is cyclical rather than purely progressive. We're not all getting better. We're not
moving towards the right side of history. That is in itself a right-wing proposition now, the idea that there is such a thing as innate human nature. And I feel that that's like a really sound foundation for comedy. In fact, that almost feels to me like, for most of my life, that's what comedy was, acknowledging the unavoidable, harsh realities of human nature and setting them comedically against our aspirations to overcome them, you know.
Yeah.
And now that seems almost like a quite regressive and reactionary... Well, I mean, I guess it is reactionary, but it's still potentially funny.
Yeah.
You know, so that's all I say, really, that, you know, you can be funny with those propositions.
Yeah, and it's good for you to get some work out of it, don't you?
Yeah, but it's funny, you know, I mean, Hal Cruttendon, we talked about this on Twitter, and he was like... oh, somebody was saying you're only left wing because you know that's what the BBC like now. And he went, oh, I wish, believe me, if I could be right wing, I would, because I'd get all that. None of us are getting any fucking work. Do you know what I mean? It's this, that is a nonsense, the idea that anyone can be left wing or right wing and then sail into a job. You know, Jeff Norcott has a regular stint on the Daily Mash. That's pretty much it. Lee Hurst hasn't been on BBC One for about 10 years because he's considered a bit too on the nose on that sort of stuff. You know, Jim Davison is, you know, it's not exactly sort of flourishing as the nation's darling.
But how much does that kind of the bitterness? I think both sides, right? You know, getting people bitter they're not on TV because they think it's weighted one way, and then you get generally older middle class white men saying, "And now it's weighted against us," and that bitterness maybe pushes some people towards that political view as well.
Who then? Who can you see who's been pushed towards that?
Lee Hurst, Andrew Lawrence have been sort of pushed to a more extreme.
Do you think they've got a lot of work out of it?
No. I think it maybe has affected their political views because they feel in a certain, you know, they feel excluded in that way.
Yeah.
In the same way that on the other side you've got.
I think Lee Hurst has probably run its course as a TV comedian. He had some good years on that. If they think it's all over, but you know, I think he would probably say. And also, he's in permanent pain with his back now and stuff, and he's a bit grumpy. But I think people like Andrew Lawrence, when they take issue with like Mock the Week, which he did, and I thought that was a sort of badly focused attack, and it lost a lot of its potential, you know, sympathy from me because he just seemed to sort of be all over the place with it. But a lot of that, it will give them some ammunition for saying, where are the people who think like me?
Yeah.
I don't know that Andrew Lawrence thinks he would have had a stellar BBC career without it. And he has had a Radio 4 show. You know, he's not been completely ignored. He's been fine. But every comedian has that little bit of like, I could have been, that could have been me, you know. But, I mean, you compare us to actors. I mean, actors, you know, every single thing they see and watch, you know, could have been them. And there's like 10 actors for every job going. You and I, you know, we make a living. Most comedians do. If they're intent on making a living and they have any talent at all, you can make a living. You sort of create your own work almost.
Yeah.
So there isn't quite the same level of bitterness, I think, in our industry that there would be in some. I think it's a legitimate concern to say we want to see some degree of representation of some sort of views, or at least not dismiss the very notion that you can be funny from a right-wing perspective, or let's say centre-right, or just centrist. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, you can. I think you've got to put those ideas out there, even to challenge them. But and on both sides, no one challenges their own ideas anymore.
No.
And everyone's getting steadfastly into those ideas. But I also think there's total freedom of speech, and people can still say whatever they want
it's
to
very
do.
Good,
and
the
truth is that the more right-wing politics is actually in the world.
Yeah.
Is succeeding. And actually, in news and current affairs, I think you'll see, you know, the balance has actually been
the
other way.
It's interesting. Well, that, you know, there is like these things seesaw, and you do. I mean, that's why it's called reactionary politics, isn't it? Because it is usually a reaction to things, to a community. I mean, Brazil, right, is under genuine, he's a genuine fascist, essentially, Bolsonaro, right? But that is a reaction to years of essentially very soft policing, very soft social policy, unaffordable welfare programs, extraordinary levels of drug abuse. You know, that doesn't come out of nowhere, those kind of, you know, they don't just go, do you know what would be a bit of a laugh? Imagine if we were under, you know, militia and they were driving around policing us in tanks, you know, just for an aesthetic change, you know. These things are a reaction in a populace that have had enough of an over, you know.
Yeah, so is it going to happen here? Because people are pretty complacent at night. So I think, like, people are saying, oh, yeah, it would never happen. You know, things will sort of... It might happen. It's getting a bit more right-wing, but we'll always keep it checks and balances.
It's not right-wing. Boris Johnson is he wants to deliver Brexit, and that, I think, you have to put into some degree of a box.
What would happen. But he is, in all important political regards, to the left of Theresa May. He's socially very liberal. He's pro-immigration. He's more immigration. To be honest, it is a disaster that he wasn't in charge of negotiations to begin with, because he would have drawn entirely different red lines. It would have taken about a year to come up with an economic, you know, EU kind of type arrangement. They would maintain freedom of movement because that wouldn't have bothered him, and he would have, you know, I don't think he actually wanted it in the first place. I agree with the proposition that he was using it as a springboard to elevate his own status, you know, but having got there, you know, he is to the left of Theresa May, and he's probably in most important, socially and economically, I think he's probably to the left of the heart of the Tory party at the moment. So I don't see that as going, you know, as Brexit being like the birth of a fascist movement. On the continent, you can see a lot of right-wing populism, definitely, yeah.
So it's September now. This will go out in December, I think.
Yeah.
Have we left the EU while the people at home are listening to this?
That is one hostage to fortune. I mean, he's pinned an awful lot on it, so I'd be amazed if he doesn't follow through somehow, but... yeah, God knows. I don't know. I would have said so this time last year. So yeah.
Al Murray, I spoke to last night. He thinks it'll be 10. They'll do an extension of 10 years.
Well, you see all these things, don't you? Like it is 2325, yeah. The year 2325, and the Prime Minister of Britain attends the traditional ceremony of the begging of an extension from Brussels. This happens every 10 years, and nobody remains. You know,
there was nothing in the referendum that said when it had to happen. No, right? Exactly. It just has to happen. We just do it. You know, we'd set it.
I personally, I mean, 75. Of the various sort of scenarios that could come out of it, I think the establishment of London as a city-state along Singaporean lines would work very well. I just think the boundary, you know, the M25 should include the A23 corridor, and I would like to see Brighton, you know, possibly as far as Worthing. I don't know exactly. We'd be like West Berlin, basically, you know, connected by a corridor.
Right. Well, let's talk about something else. We'll see if you are right. We're not going to go on much longer because, you know, it's a long old night, isn't it? Someone's got to get home to Hertfordshire. That's going to say London.
Is that where you live? Is that where your school
is? Yeah, I live in
are?
Hertfordshire now, yeah.
Are you? Well, whereabouts?
I'm not telling these people.
I grew up in St Albans.
Well, you're born in Luton. I'm quite near to Luton. I'm quite near to Hitcham.
Okay.
I nearly lived in St Albans.
Yeah.
It's nice down there.
It's the heart of comedy there, yeah. Well, it used to be all right, you know, a lot of pubs. Yeah, a lot of pubs. It's a bit of a dormitory now.
Well, Luton's a horrible place, though, right? We can all agree on that. And I live very near to it.
Luton, or as EasyJet call it, London.
Well, it didn't become the worst. They recently did a survey. It's usually Luton, but Belfast was the worst one now.
Oh, right.
So Luton's not even the best at being
the
worst.
I haven't been back there. I mean, I never lived there. I was born there because that was a local hospital. But, no, I grew up in St Albans, which is...
That's more suited to you.
Got an abbey and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all right.
That's more suited to you. Right, we'll do an emergency questions or two.
Okay.
And then we will call it a day. You had a nice time so far, Brighton?
Yeah.
Oh. They're lovely.
It's warm, isn't it? Is it just me?
I'm wearing a jumper, so I'm fucking boiling. It's on the poster. People expect to see it.
You must be really prickly.
Yeah. Ugh. It is actually... last week's guest, Annabelle, was saying, does fluff come off it? I said, no, I don't think so. But then I've been noticing my fluff just gradually gravitating towards your mouth. Luckily, you've got this kind of beard around here that gets caught up. But I'm sure Annabelle ate quite a lot of my jumper. Part of a payment. This jumper is so expensive that actually is...
It's very slimming, though.
Yes. Thank you. We'll go one emergency question. Let's see which one I can find. I'm not going...
Okay.
That's too long.
You're going to the back again.
I'm going to the back.
We went to the back backstage,
and the back
shouldn't
is...
Shouldn't I, like, stick my finger in a... Should I not be allowed to pick a card?
Well, it's
does a not work?
Risky. It doesn't always work. Let's try this one. I don't know what this is. Do you think the voice in your head that you perceive as yourself is the one making the actual decisions, or is there a shadowy other you for whom the you voice is just a toadying spokesperson who never speaks but makes all the actual choices that the you voice then has to justify to you?
Confabulation. I mean, normally that would sound quite neutral, but off the back of the right-wing politics discussion, sounds like an accusation, doesn't it?
But that's the theory, isn't it? There's meant to be you justify every decision you make and create
the separate hemispheres and you guys are hilarious and all that stuff. Yeah, Yeah, I wrote a sitcom once where a man had his... he was a scientist. He had the hemispheres of his brain deliberately separated so he could play himself at chess.
Right.
And you just have to have... Apparently, you can do that, and then you don't tell what the other one is doing, yeah, and thinking and planning. But there was a famous experiment, wasn't there, that demonstrated that people were making decisions, thinking they'd made decisions half a second after they had.
Yeah, that's right. I think
and this very week, I don't know if you're aware of it, it's been refuted. It's part of the reproducibility crisis, which has afflicted the whole of psychological and social investigation for the last 50 years. None of these experiments worked the second time you do them. And that one turns out to be bollocks as well. Oh, so free will is back on the agenda.
Hooray! Yeah, it was exactly the right person, yes, to ask the question to. I've never asked it before. Have you ever seen...
I do think, though, that as David Hume said, that the passions are king, and reason can only ever and should only ever aspire to be the slave of the passions. Yeah. Your passions determine your course of action, and reason, your rational mind, your intelligence, is there to justify it afterwards. And essentially, the more intelligent you are, the more capable of hypocrisy you are. That's all it is.
It is true. I don't know if I... We did an interview in Edinburgh a long time ago, which I did listen to again. It's amazing how much of this stuff I just forget happens.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know if I ask you this question. Have you ever seen a ghost, Simon?
Oh, that is quite a good one. Didn't see that coming. No pun intended. No, I don't believe I have. But it's quite a divisive issue in my family.
Is it?
My Aunt Margaret, who is also Christian, which is supposed to eliminate the use of ghosts, I thought.
Well...
But, yeah, church ghosts, yeah, really fierce. And if this conversation comes up at Christmas, as it usually does, you know, there is no laughing or joking around about ghosts. She saw them, and she saw the ghost of her father sit on the end of her bed on the night he died, apparently, and tell her that he was going. So,
why did she get that? Why didn't everyone get that?
Yeah,
that's
exactly, because she's the daughter, I guess. I've never really felt paranormal activity, but I have been with a dog that seemed to react to something like that.
That was going to be a different story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But nothing here we go. So
a lot of ectoplasm. A lot of ectoplasm on the dog.
You've had a dog that's seen a ghost.
Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't go into a certain room in a...
It was a ghost of another dog. Do dogs see dog ghosts and we see human ghosts?
That's a good question.
We don't often see dog ghosts. Not many people go, I saw the ghost of a dog or a cat or a sheep. Sort of dead.
Well, the Hound of the Baskervilles was the ghost of a dog, that's wasn't true, it? But it turned out not to be. But maybe that was the ingenious adaptation. No, I mean, that whole thing, that's the first time when things get complicated in heaven, isn't it? Where the dogs go to heaven, but you get all your dogs at once, or because they might not all get on.
Well, and husbands and wives, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's usually, you know which one, isn't there, if you're honest. We'd all be able to pick out the heaven squad.
And, you know, it's not fair if, you know, my wife will probably go to heaven and I probably won't go to heaven. My wife's deprived of me for eternity.
Are you set because you mock and ridicule the Christian church?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he'll let me
in. As long as you love your fellow man, that's said to be
I don't really like
you
him.
You don't like him either, no. That's the problematic area. But you can always, you know, have a proper Catholic confession in the last half an hour.
It would be nice, but you think Jesus and God are going to be like you are. But he probably isn't. He's probably going to go... Fuck you. Your parents didn't even have the right one of me.
Well, there's no version of heaven I've ever heard that sounds even tolerable, let alone appealing. Yeah. I mean, most of them, you know, written by anyone who has any real vested interest in it, you know, it amounts to endless worship, doesn't it? And bathing in the glory, you know, which is very egotistical. I like to be the one emanating glory. I think we've both chosen professions. Yeah. There's no point in pretending otherwise, you know. I like to be on the throne. I don't want to be there. So I would be cast out fairly quickly.
You might take over. Satan had a go.
Better Satan, exactly. Better Satan in hell than second in command.
I mean, Satan must have thought he had a chance, right? So there must be a weakness there somewhere.
Well, he did have a chance. He's had a fucking riot. Yeah. Jesus.
Yes.
He's had the best of the last 2,000 years, surely. That should be obvious.
Good. On that bombshell... Ladies and gentlemen, please go down for Simon Edwards. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming, everyone. I'll see you in the bar. Please give some money to Stoke if you so wish. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Chang, and my guest, Simon Evans. Thank you to Pest for playing this music once again for us. They do it every week. They're very nice. Thank you to everyone at the Theatre Royal in Brighton, to everyone at Acast and the British Comedy Guide. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, and all the team at Go Faster Stripe and the guys who film these shows for me. You're legends. We have such fun. Thanks, guys. The producer is James Hingley. The series producer is, of course, a man I'm indebted to, Ben Walker. The executive producer of this show is Andy Sandel. Like you wear on your feet in the beach. They're handy sandals. He didn't want me to take the piss out of his name. That was one of his notes that he gave me. But sometimes you have to disregard the executive producer to produce fantastic work. This is a Fuzz, Go Faster Stripe and Sky Potato production. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rahula Stupper and Richard Herring-based Christmas present needs. You can buy all three Emergency Questions books for just £20. Three Christmas gifts, three fantastic Secret Santas. Also lots of downloads, lots of other books, lots of DVDs if you're still into that. Fist of Fun, Oh Friggin' 50, all kinds of stuff still available. GoFasterStripe.com, my friends. RichardHerring.com/gigs if you want to come and see me on tour in 2020. London and Norwich confirmed so far. Birmingham will also be up there soon. Love you guys. Take care of yourselves. And don't go changing too much. All right? Yeah, I know. See you. Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. RichardHerring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And GoFasterStripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show. If you enjoyed it, if you want to see me, that'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.